Welcome back. In my last lecture, I talked about the development of agricultural societies in the Maya heartland, in the Maya lowlands and highlands of Mesoamerica. And what I particularly want to emphasize here is the changes in the ways in which we've thought about this development of agricultural systems in this region through time. Historically, archaeologists have conceived of this as a very slow, gradual development of progressively larger communities through the first millennium BC. And today, it appears a little more complicated than that, with a phase of colonization between about 1200 BC and 600 BC. But then, in the middle of the first millennium BC, a significant acceleration in the pace of cultural and political change. This, in a sense, finds its greatest expression, at least in terms of scale, in the appearance of the great site of El Mirador in the Maya lowlands in the latter part of the first millennium BC. So the geographical spread of Maya urbanism and Maya political complexity reached its peak between about AD 250 and AD 800. During this time, this part of Mesoamerica, the Maya lowlands, the Maya highlands, were home to dozens of urban settlements of different sizes and thousands of Maya communities. Only quite recently have archaeologists realized that this fluorescence occurred in the context of the widespread political collapse at El Mirador and related sites in the early first millennium AD. So we have to think then of the potential repercussions of the removal of this political center, the repercussions for the decline and collapse of El Mirador across the whole region. And we have to expect that that would have allowed opportunities for other sites to develop in somewhat the same way, for example, that the contemporary disappearance of Cuicuilco in the Valley of Mexico seems to correspond with the rise of Teotihuacan. So this change in our view of political developments alters the context of the archaeological debate. The Maya states of the first millennium AD did not appear through a slow process of evolution from earlier chiefdoms. Rather, they expanded during a period of widespread political and social dislocation, almost perhaps an earlier equivalent of the widely debated Maya collapse that I'll talk about in a future lecture. This also implies that the original development of states in the Maya region happened much earlier and probably more quickly in the first millennium BC, and that process is not very well understood. And this is some place where we can again productively compare regions in different parts of the world. Do events in the Maya heartland resemble, for example, processes that went on in Mesopotamia, where we do see a relatively gradual development through time, or perhaps in the Nile Valley, where political processes seem to have happened rather more quickly? Some Maya sites, like Tikal, one that I'm going to talk about a good deal in this lecture, seem to have originally developed at the same time as El Mirador, but they continued to flourish and indeed expanded after the abandonment of that site. So there are some sites like Tikal that persist and flourish and increase in size and complexity through the time period when El Mirador is abandoned, through the collapse. But for the most part, however, the well-known Maya urban centers really expanded in the 3rd century AD and later. That is, after the collapse of El Mirador. These include sites like Huaxactun, Caracol, Calakmul, Copan, and Palenque. Progress in understanding the dynamics and potentials of Maya agriculture has revolutionized our views of Mayan societies over the last 30 years. Through most of the 20th century, it was believed that the Maya practiced only low-intensity, mobile, slash-and-burn agriculture. I've talked about these agricultural systems before. Such agricultural systems can only support relatively low population densities, and thus probably could not sustain large urban populations. Given these assumptions, Maya centers were thus conceived of as largely ritual and ceremonial locations, occupied by only small groups of elites, their servants, and custodians. They would draw upon larger hinterlands with scattered rural populations. Of course, you will note that the corollary here is that archaeologists thought of the Maya to some degree in the way that today we think about the Olmec. This raises the question of whether our images of Olmec agriculture may be similarly oversimplified. That's going to require further archaeological work. But it is known that Maya farming systems during the first millennium AD at least were much more sophisticated and far more diverse than earlier thought. Maya farmers largely relied on cultivation of a triad of plant staples, corn, beans, and squash, although manioc was also regionally important. Those Maya farmers routinely engaged in multi-year cycles when the cultivation of different crops was followed by periods of field regeneration, while in some areas, especially around urban centers, terracing and fertilizing of fields was used to prolong periods of cultivation. One central element in these farming systems was water control. And I noted in my last lecture the necessity of water control in a relatively dry tropical forest environment that is both well drained, so that the water does not stand for long periods, and subject to periodic drought. And so we see Maya farmers provisioning themselves with irrigation systems, while the construction of large reservoirs seems to have been an important element in Maya central planning. And these constructions allowed farming to continue through the periodic droughts that afflict the Maya lowlands in particular. Our views of the Maya and of Maya urban centers and Maya political systems are thus transformed. We know now that cities like Tikal, Caracol, Calakmul had populations of 50 to 60,000 people grouped around a central core of pyramids, temples, and palaces housing the ruling elites, with perhaps hundreds of thousands more people living in the larger territories of these urban centers. Smaller centers like Copan or Altun Ha probably housed 10,000 to 20,000 people. Our views of Maya social and political systems changed at the same time as did our views of Maya urbanism, and in part for related reasons. Until the 1950s, it was frequently assumed that Maya society was relatively peaceful when compared to that of, for example, the Teotihuacan state in Highland Mexico. Small Maya populations would perhaps reduce the need for and the damage of warfare. A recognition that Maya populations were much larger than earlier believed, combined with developing understandings of Maya artwork and writings, led to the realization that political competition and warfare between Maya centers was common, indeed endemic, and that that warfare was frequently very destructive. We're going to examine the decipherment of Maya scripts and the ways in which that decipherment has revolutionized Mesoamerican archaeology in my next lecture. So, what were these Maya cities like? They're quite diverse, in fact. And there are so many of them that it would be impossible for us to examine each separately. Perhaps the best course, then, the best course for us to follow, is to look at the characteristics and the history of two such sites, Tikal and Palenque. So let's take those as not entirely universal examples, but representative examples of different kinds of Maya urban centers. Let's start with Tikal. Tikal is situated in northern Guatemala, about 60 kilometers or 40 miles south of El Mirador. Ceremonial structures, I noted this, ceremonial structures were being laid out at Tikal at about 100 BC, at the time when El Mirador was flourishing. But it's notable that the period of expansion of the site of Tikal is the period when El Mirador declines in power. The removal of this powerful competitor at El Mirador seems to be important. The ceremonial center at Tikal was laid out in a series of architectural complexes that encompassed pyramids, plazas, temples, ball courts, palaces, and other buildings, in generally arrangements that are similar to those that we've already seen in other parts of Mesoamerica. The largest of these complexes at Tikal are known as the North, South, East, and Central Acropolises, although each was probably built up gradually over periods of decades or centuries. So we have this large complex of monumental architecture, in some ways unique to the site, but in other ways reminiscent of similar kinds of architectural complexes that we've seen in Highland and Lowland Mesoamerica to this point. By AD 250, the North Acropolis at Tikal, this large complex, had been laid out and partly finished, as were the Great Plaza and the North Terrace. By AD 350, then, after the collapse of El Mirador, and as the site is in full expansion, the site of Tikal is in full expansion, by AD 350, a long ditch or moat had been completed. And this extends for about 9.5 kilometers or about 6 miles around the site. Now, this ditch has usually been assumed to be a defensive feature, as we could certainly understand. But it's possible that it was actually part of a water control system, that is, a large reservoir. And so we have to again think of our analogies. We have to think of our interpretations of sites like this and the ways in which these interpretations are to some degree conditioned by prior assumptions about the nature of ancient societies. Do we think of Maya society as generally warlike, militaristic, or was it a society that was more preoccupied with agricultural intensification, water control, and so on? And of course, these are not necessarily exclusive preoccupations by any means. Most of the rest of the monumental architecture at Tikal dates to a later period of its domination over neighboring areas in the Maya lowlands, between the 7th and 9th centuries AD. So what we see then at Tikal is, to an extent, two phases of political fluorescence. One immediately after the collapse of El Mirador, and one significantly later in the first millennium AD. I want to note here one particular characteristic of the Tikal site, one that I haven't mentioned up to this point, but is one that's a striking example of the connections, the cultural connections between practices of Mesoamerican elites. And this is the occurrence at Tikal of ball courts. The ball courts at Tikal and at other Maya sites were locations for a culturally and ritually important game that is, again, found throughout Mesoamerica from Olmec times onward. Ball courts and figurines of ball game players have been found at Olmec and contemporary sites, and in fact later at Teotihuacan as well. One thing I'll note is one of the most striking classes of artifacts that we see associated with Olmec culture are these colossal heads, these colossal stone heads that appear to depict Olmec rulers, or at least some sort of Olmec elite figures. They've often been called football players because of the particular form of headdress that they wear. And in fact, this does seem to be a headdress for playing the Mesoamerican ball game. Most major Maya centers include a court for the ball game. This is not unique to Tikal by any means. This is a very, very general phenomenon, a cultural phenomenon. The Mesoamerican ball game was not merely a sporting event. It seems to have functioned in at least some areas and sometimes as a substitute for more extensive warfare, and was woven deeply into Mayan mythology. And one could, I suppose, make analogies here with football or perhaps baseball in American society as well. I'm not quite so sure about the substitution for warfare, but a very important activities culturally, socially, and so on. For the Maya, although not necessarily for other Mesoamerican cultures that played the ball game, because as I said, this ball game was shared among a variety of different Mesoamerican societies, but that doesn't mean that it was perceived of, conceived of the same way in all cases. For the Maya, though, human sacrifice seems to have been associated with at least some matches of the ball game. And this is often suggested to have involved sacrifice of members of the losing team, which is a parallel, fortunately, that we don't see with modern North American sports, for example. The residential areas of Tikal cover an area of approximately 15,000 acres. In contrast to Teotihuacan, as far as we can see, these residential areas were not planned. They were not laid out in a manner so orderly as was the case at Teotihuacan, although the civic and ceremonial center of Tikal certainly was. The system of ceremonial Sac Bay roadways, first appearing at El Mirador and Nac Bay, are much elaborated at Tikal, connecting ceremonial areas within the site. In other cases, although not, it seems, at Tikal, Sac Bay roadways provide links between Maya sites. These are most spectacularly preserved at Coba on the northeastern Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, where a series of 16 such ceremonial causeways are known. The longest of these Sacbe at Coba stretches for 100 kilometers or 60 miles and links Coba with another Maya center at Yaxchana. The Sacbe seems to provide a sort of cosmological structure to political relations between communities. So we can imagine, for example, ceremonial processions undertaken by rulers and elites along these roadways, visiting other centers. And these processions would probably have both political and religious importance. If we wanted an analogy, we might see these almost as the physical manifestations, of an architectural manifestation of the mandalas that I talked about, these conceptions of webs of political relationships between urban centers that I spoke about in Southeast Asia. In a sense, the Sacbe, these webs of Sacbe, are analogous conceptions made concrete. With an improving understanding of Maya writing and the Maya calendar, to be discussed in the next lecture, it's possible to construct a partial history of Tikal, as with other Maya centers. This involves dates and other historical information recorded on stela, limestone slab monuments erected to commemorate events such as the dedication of a temple, the death of a ruler, accessions to the throne, and so on. This allows archaeologists to identify what appears to be a period of great influence on Tikal from Teotihuacan, from the Valley of Mexico, hundreds of miles away, which may even include the deposal of an indigenous Tikal ruler and the installation of a ruler from Teotihuacan in his place. I've already mentioned this episode, and I'll come back to it again in my next lecture. The implications, though, of this episode for our understanding of both Tikal and Teotihuacan are obvious. It would indicate that Teotihuacan was far from being the peaceful commercial empire that some archaeologists have claimed. The Teotihuacan dynasty seems to have led Tikal into a period of substantial prosperity and expansion in the late 4th and 5th centuries AD. Although, after that time, relations with Teotihuacan seem to have been cut off and a century-long decline set in, probably associated with the defeat of Tikal by the state of Caracol. And I want to note here, now we're getting to the point where we can accumulate this kind of detailed historical evidence of the rise and falls in the fortunes of particular Maya states at Tikal. This was followed by a period of recovery between about AD 600 and AD 800, a time that saw a great deal of building, was indeed a sort of renaissance for Tikal. I'll note that this marks a period of substantial integration of Maya culture regionally, with high levels of trade between centers and what appears to be efficient administrative systems. By the late 9th century AD, though, Tikal had suffered a substantial decline in power, and the last stela written on the site is dated to AD 869. By that time, ceremonial construction at Tikal and writing had ceased, and the population had decreased dramatically. There were many other Maya centers, Copan, Saibal, Calakmul, Bonampak, and so on. I want to very briefly discuss just one other, Palenque, in Chiapas, as an illustration of the diversity within an overall Mayan civilization. The known history of Palenque spans a later period than that at Tikal, from about AD 431 to AD 800. Palenque was a much smaller urban center than Tikal, and unlike the latter city, it doesn't seem to have had very much peripheral settlement around the ceremonial center. The population was likely only 6,000 to 8,000 people, and Palenque probably controlled only a relatively small area. Palenque is very different from many other Maya sites. It doesn't display a number of, quote, traditional, unquote, Maya traits. It has few stela. There were no great plaza and no sacbes. At the same time, it was obviously an important place. New and generally lighter architectural styles predominate. Elite tombs are no longer found in pyramids, but there is evidence for elaborate funeral rites at the specially built Temple of Inscriptions. Portraits, this is interesting, portraits of Palenque's rulers seem to be much less idealized and less standardized and more realistic than those found at many other Maya centers. Extraordinarily, depictions of members of the elite on art and sculpture from Palenque are sufficiently realistic to allow diagnosis of acromegaly, a clinical enlargement of the extremities and face, clubfoot, and polydactyly, extra fingers and toes, among members of the elite. These conditions were probably a result of inbreeding. Rulers were semi-divine, and they could only marry a very restricted group of people. Palenque's rulers seem to have made efforts to immortalize themselves that were unusual even by Mayan standards. Equally unusual was the fact that one of these rulers was, in fact, a woman, whose son ruled after her. This was justified through appeal to the origin myths of the Maya, and especially through identification of the rulers of Palenque with the descendants of the first mother of all humans. Palenque continued to be an important center into the 8th century AD, but at that point, its power began to decline. The last named ruler in the city of Palenque is referred to in an inscription dated to AD 799. But that inscription is on a small pot found during archaeological excavations and not on an impressive stela, which is a little pathetic, actually. After that time, the city largely fades from history. Palenque was never as regionally influential as Tikal, and it was politically much less powerful. There doesn't seem to have been a great deal of trade associated with the center. It seems to have been more a ceremonial city, and perhaps even a necropolis for its great leaders, and thus has quite a different character from Tikal. This variation in just two sites is a salutary reminder for archaeologists. Within a vibrant and quite cohesive civilization like that of the Maya, we also have to expect, and we should welcome indeed the analysis of, significant local variation, even at the level of kingship and regional rule. For my next lecture, I want to talk in a little more detail about the transformation in archaeological understandings of Maya kingship and Maya rule, in large part as a result of really wonderful developments in the interpretation of Maya writings. Thank you.